Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to the Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. As we record, it's the afternoon of February 8th, and we're just one day away from the beginning of Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. On today's episode, we're joined by CNN legal analyst and former New Jersey state prosecutor and prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, Ellie Honig. Ellie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Reed.
And we're also joined by the co-founder of the nonprofit law firm Whistleblower Aid, Mark Zaid. Thanks for coming, Mark.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You know, at the Lincoln Project, we started saying last year, and our listeners have heard this, that we didn't believe that the campaign would be over until Joe Biden took the oath of office on January 20th. And sometimes you just hate to be right. We knew that he would not go quietly into that good night. He certainly didn't. But all that culminated on January 6th, when folks incited by him, I believe, stormed the Capitol and ultimately sacked the building, all because they were trying to prevent Mike Pence and the United States Congress from taking their constitutional action to open the electoral votes, count them, and then ultimately make Joe Biden the president. So, Mark, I want to start with you because you have experience in the impeachment of Donald Trump from last year around Ukraine. So are there any similarities between what you saw last year, or is it just a general Donald Trump was an abuser of his office and this was likely to be one outcome?
You know, I'm sure we could come up with lots of parallels to some extent. And I think what has made this so either difficult or confusing or complicated in the sort of general media sense in the public is this discussion and understanding of the interplay between what the law allows, what the Constitution allows, and what politics allows or dictates. You know, even when we talk about the constitutionality, et cetera, in both cases, at the end of the day, this is really all about politics. And there are some legal issues that shape it without a doubt. But a lot of what we've heard from members on both sides, but especially the Republican side, I think has been to confuse the issue by placing into play legal issues, especially on the criminality aspect of things that just don't have a role.
So, Ellie, you've been a prosecutor for a long, long time. And I think Mark makes a good point. Now, impeachment is an inherently political process, right? It is carried out by elected officials of the United States House of Representatives. The U.S. Senate serves as the jury, which, you know, they set their own rules, which is must be interesting for someone like you who probably went into court, at least with a, I would assume, a very good understanding of the rules you were playing by. In your mind, anyway, where do the politics and the law meet on this?
One thing that I had to get used to last year at Trump impeachment part one was reminding myself, and a lot of my fellow former prosecutors out here in the media went through the same thing. This is not a criminal trial. This is not a criminal proceeding. There's so much that's different. I mean, start with your jury. In a criminal trial, your jury is 12 people who know nothing about a case and they're impartial. Here you have 100 jurors, senators who are already on a team, many of whom have already announced where they're going to come out. The burden of proof in a criminal case, you have to prove your case as a prosecutor beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, the burden of proof is I've heard it said whatever the Senate decides, but that's not even accurate. It's what each individual senator decides because different senators can just use different burdens of proof or none whatsoever. Rules of evidence. When you're doing a criminal trial or a civil trial, only certain types of evidence can come into the record in certain ways. Here, you could just play a clip off of CNN. I mean, you can't do that in a criminal trial, but I believe that's what we'll see. We'll see plenty of clips of things off of social media and off the news. They can be admissible in criminal cases, but here it's anything goes. And it's worth bearing in mind, one of the ways Donald Trump slipped loose, I think, on last year's impeachment, Ukraine, was by constantly conflating the two, criminal and impeachment, and saying, well, they didn't even allege a crime. And if you remember last year's articles of impeachment, there is no specific statutory federal crime alleged or charged. And the response from Democrats was, but we don't need to. And that's right. But he still managed to, I think, make a good amount of headway by bringing in criminal standards or court standards only when convenient.
And so, Mark, you were at the heart of last year's impeachment that went back to the infamous perfect phone call with the Ukrainian president of, I guess, the summer of 2019 now. But in that case, in that trial, it was a foregone conclusion that Donald Trump would be acquitted. It was a campaign year. Many of these senators were also candidates in active elections. And so the case went forth despite the fact that there was little to no chance that he would be convicted, thrown out of office, or whatever. It also now appears that he will be acquitted this time because, of course, the burden is 2/3 of the United States Senate, 67 senators. So if we know that maybe we get 5, 6, maybe 10 Republican senators would vote to convict, is it still worth having the trial?
Good question. And, you know, it's interesting because in the first case, when the Republicans and the strategists found out, or maybe even really just the talking heads on the alt-right found out that I had tweeted in January of 2017 that there was going to be a coup, which I was referring to when Sally Yates was fired as the acting attorney general. And I was just referring to the fact that people inside the government were going to stand up to Trump. And at the end of the day, the law and the lawyers would prevail. And I wrote, impeachment will follow, because I'd love to say how prescient I am and extraordinarily intelligent. But I think pretty much anybody who was objective at the time, as soon as Trump was inaugurated, could predict that impeachment at some point in time was going to happen, just given his behavior. But I also said prior to impeachment that I'm not quite sure if it made sense to do it because the writing was on the wall, like you said, in that he was going to be acquitted. And much of this with respect to impeachment comes down to optics. And optics, you know, because perception can become reality, is so very important. So here we see that, again, Trump will likely be acquitted. But I'd love to see 10 Republican senators stand up and say that he should be barred from future office, which is really what this proceeding is about. You know, that would really send a message because that's about optics. So even if he was acquitted, there's going to be some value. Historically, there's clearly some value by this. But there is a danger from a precedental standpoint, too, as to how this is going to proceed forward when the Republicans take power or a new party, if there's some sort of offshoot party that is formed by the Lincoln Project and others. Who knows? Hopefully so. It would be great to see. But, you know, I hesitate because the reality is we may all have amongst the three of us different opinions. We may overlap, and I'm sure we do on a lot of things. And I don't think any one of us is necessarily going to be right or wrong about those opinions about whether this should take place or not. And I think if I were a U.S. senator, my view would be different than as just a lawyer having an opinion about these things. So I struggle with this question very much so. And it's hard to come up with, I think, an answer that will ever please everybody, because there's no way of that.
So Ellie, let me ask, as a former prosecutor now, if you were going to be a prosecutor, I guess a House impeachment manager in this context, what would you be looking for as far as your main basis of argument first? And second, given the unique nature of the jury, and I put that in air quotes, although you can't see it, would you be looking to speak to specific senators on things that they cared about? Or are you trying to make the broadest, most convincing case possible, as Mark said, because of the optical necessity of it?
So let me take the second part of that first, Reed. I would view my audience not so much as the individual men and women who are senators sitting in that well, because they're going to do what they're going to do. And they're going to be guided above and beyond all else by what? By the polling numbers, right? By how it's going to play politically. And we saw this poll come out over the weekend that showed, I was surprised how high it was, but 56% of the public believes Trump should be impeached and convicted and disqualified. That's a significant number. And if I'm a House impeachment manager, essentially prosecuting this case, I'm thinking if I can just tick that number up a bit, if it starts to get to the 60 range, 61 range, that could really catch the attention of senators from maybe your more swing states or purple states, you know, whatever you want, maybe your Lincoln Project type senators. And that would be how I would go about this. So it's sort of like a use the backboard here. I would indirectly try to appeal to the ultimate audience. how would I present this case? You know, the first thing I think you have to do is remind your audience, let's not get numb to all of this. And it's a hard thing, right? When there's so much malfeasance and so much abuse of power, it all just tends to sort of, you get numb to it, right? I used to sometimes say this to juries. If we had a case where there was so much criminality, I would do cases, trials against mob bosses, mob captains, and we'd charge them with 14 acts of violence, including 6 murders. And at times in closing, I would just stand in front of the jury and go, I know we've all been living this for the last month or however long the trial's been, but try to put yourself just in the mindset that you were in before you ever came into this courtroom, to remind yourself how, I wouldn't quite use this phrase, but how crazy this is, right? How abnormal this is, how unacceptable this is. And I would want to make this point. I'm actually interested in what you both hear. I mean, I would do all the visceral stuff. I would show all the horrible videos from the Capitol. I would remind people what it was like that day. I would use Trump's tweets against him, especially, by the way, the one after the Capitol riot when Trump said, you're great patriots. I mean, I don't know how he responds to that. But let me run this by the two of you. I'm interested what you think. What if the Capitol was never stormed? What if there was never anyone that breached the Capitol? Wouldn't it still be impeachable if what Trump did is A, lie about the election results, and B, try to get the vice president to exceed his constitutional authority and reverse the results? I mean, in a normal world, if I told you this 20 years ago, you have a president, he's going to lose the election, he's going to lie to the American public, claim he won, and he's going to pressure the vice president to flip the result to him. Wouldn't that alone be impeachable?
Well, I'm obviously very biased in this regard, so I would say yes. But Mark, what do you think?
In a normal world, in the old world where we used to operate, yeah, I think it would be. I think that would have been unheard of in prior political history. You know, part of the problem, I think, that they're also going to have, and it probably won't make a difference to the senators who have already made up their mind, which is certainly a number of them, but the notion of arguing that what Trump was advocating is impeachable when some of the senators, like Cruz and Hawley, were basically doing the same thing. And whether advocating that point of view is saying you, the jurors, some of you are just as guilty, were enablers as to Trump, which, you know, legally we can agree on, politically we might be able to agree on, but from an advocate standpoint, that's a dangerous, slippery slope for the impeachment managers because you're going to taint some of the jurors. Hawley and Cruz are clearly voting to acquit. But what about some of these other senators who are possibly on the fence? Where do they stand? And, you know, part of this is going to come down to things that the American public aren't going to understand or know. What's the personal relationship between some of the senators? What committees are the senators on? Is there something that one senator might need going forward for a particular hearing that could be influenced by one of these other senators who would vote one way versus the other? There's such a bigger picture for something like this that most people, except for those who are in the weeds on politics, are never going to take into account, but which is going to have an impact on how these senators vote.
I'm going to ask a political question of two attorneys. If you're a United States senator who signed on to the bogus Supreme Court deal coming out of Ken Paxton in Texas, the attorney general down there, and then you voted to overturn or object to electoral votes on January 6th, and then you voted to table the impeachment articles 2 weeks ago, which 45 Republican senators did, and now you've already made your mind up and you're going to acquit Donald Trump. To me, as a political guy, they're four-time losers when it comes to democracy. They all know what they're doing. And the expression, they know better, of course they know better, they just don't care. And so from my perspective, if you're standing there in the well as a manager, do you call them out? The other question is for some of those who might be, say, the Rob Portmans of the world, the Pat Toomeys of the world, the Richard Burrs of the world, who have declared that they're retiring, they're not coming back. Can you say, if you had been caught by these guys, you might not be sitting here today? Do we believe that has any effect on these folks?
Those are both really interesting tactical decisions, and it's such a bizarre scenario we're in here, even within the already bizarre world of impeachment, because your jury is all witnesses, potentially victims, and some of them even co-conspirators, so to speak, right, involved in the conduct. So the conflict is everywhere. I think on your second point, I would absolutely make that point. I don't think the senators need to be beaten over the head with it. They were there, but I would certainly remind them that had this gone a little different way, had things, you know, that day on January 6th sparked off a slightly different direction, some of you all could have been hurt. I would say it a little more artfully than that. That I think is low risk. The other one, how clear are you? How explicitly, how strongly do you call out the Cruises and the Hawleys is a little more of a difficult calculus. On the one hand, the fighter in me wants to say, yeah, get up and point in their face and name names and call them out for what they did, because it's so disgraceful, it's so dangerous. And I agree with you, Mark. Reed, I agree with what you just said. I don't think they believe this. I don't think Hawley and Cruz truly believe the election was stolen. They're play acting here. On the other hand, though, the Senate is a place for niceties. They like their formalities. They like their gentleman or gentlewoman scholar type, you know, thing that they put on with the ceremonial stuff. And it might rankle some of the persuadable folks in the middle if you start pointing into the well and saying, you and you are part of this too. So I think what I would do would be to make clear that this is part of a longer effort by Donald Trump, the culmination of a longer effort, Reed, to use a word you used before that I think is a good one here. I would probably say there were a lot of other enablers, but I think as much as it might feel good to point out Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and say you and you, I think the better part of valor might be to be a bit subtler about that.
I want to take a step back on two things. One is, Mark, given your experience last year, so we're going to have the impeachment managers, Democrats from the United States House. We'll have the 100 senators sitting as a jury, although one of them, Senator Pat Leahy, will actually also be serving as the, I guess, judge, because Chief Justice John Roberts, I don't know if he declined to participate, said he's not going to participate because Trump is not in office any longer. And that seems to be one of the process arguments that a lot of the president's defenders are using, which is, he is no longer in office, therefore impeachment is invalid. That's one. Two is, the president has every First Amendment right that anybody else does. And three, I heard, we listened to a clip last week where the president's attorney said, we should not and cannot diminish passionate political speech. Those were his words. So where, you know, again, we're back into this weird nexus of politics and the law. But it seems to me that what the Democrats and the prosecutors are saying is, if you murdered somebody when you were sitting in your office, just because you're not sitting in your office anymore doesn't mean you didn't kill the person. So how do we unwrap all that to make it understandable for Americans who, to Ellie's point, may not be in the jury, but certainly, you know, are in the court of public opinion and will have a chance to judge these people on their own, you know, less than 2 years from now?
I am disappointed that Chief Justice Roberts is not sitting in the position as judge. And that goes to the optics of what we're talking about, because a good swath of the population is just going to denounce this proceeding as completely political, even though it always was from the outset, just by its nature, because Pat Leahy, a Democrat, will be sitting as the judge. And I haven't seen any actual factual statements about how that analysis came about. My understanding is because the Constitution speaks to the president and having the Chief Justice be as the jurist, because Trump is no longer president, that someone made the interpretation that that means the Chief Justice can't play a role, or maybe he said that. And that's unfortunate, but the lawyer in me, if that is the explanation, understands that, because they're literally interpreting the words as written. At the same time, how that plays out then will obviously factor into so much of everything, especially depending on how Leahy adjudicates anything. Although I'm not quite sure there's going to be much to adjudicate. I don't think there's going to be any witnesses. I think we should probably talk a little bit about that, because that's a very interesting point, and also obviously can tee into how the first impeachment went. In fact, I think one of the key differences would be the role witnesses could have played in the first impeachment versus how they could or not play a role in this particular impeachment.
Let's talk about the witnesses, because, you know, Ellie, and I assume in any trial you've ever been a part of, there are witnesses. The accused can determine whether or not they want to sit and be questioned in their own defense, but they don't have to. Trump has said he's not going to participate as a witness. Lindsey Graham said, you know, you better not call witnesses. But why would they not? If we know that there's a very good chance at the foregone conclusion is that Trump will be acquitted. Why would the impeachment managers and the Democrats in the Senate and maybe those five or six Republicans who go along with them not take the opportunity to have a full accounting of what happened on January 6th and frankly, those days leading up to it?
It's a good question. And by the way, there is an interesting dynamic at play here, because if we remember, Mark just talked about this last year's impeachment when the Republicans controlled the Senate and there was that dramatic vote where they decided no witnesses, Democrats flipped out, right? I mean, and I think rightly so. And I think I wrote a piece at the time sarcastically talking about, well, it's congratulations, everybody. We've had a witness-free, evidence-free trial. What a joke. I mean, I'm paraphrasing myself here, but I think a lot of people felt that way. And now I agree. It looks to me like the House impeachment managers are inching towards this. We're not going to call any witnesses. Now, in a world where there were no timing considerations, no practical political considerations, I think you absolutely would call witnesses. You would call people who are inside the Capitol. You might call, if you wanted to really go, it probably wouldn't be admissible in a regular court, but if you really wanted to go for an emotional gut punch, you maybe call a relative of someone who was killed, one of, you know, the officer or something like that. You'd have to be careful about how you did that. But you really want to drive home the personal cost of this. I think there's a big difference between the two fact scenarios, though, the Ukraine fact scenario and the one now. Which Mark, I think, alluded to, which is there was so much unknown about Ukraine. For example, the John Bolton testimony that never was, right? We know from reporting, we know now from John Bolton's book, I'm glad he sold a lot of books, that he was a direct eyewitness. Donald Trump said to him, I'm paraphrasing this, but Bolton said, Donald Trump said to me, I'm leaning on them, you know, I'm using this foreign aid to lean on them so they'll investigate the Bidens. Like, that's my motive here. That was the key question. And you could have had someone who had that sort of access to a conversation that we would never and did not know about at the time because Bolton never testified. Here, I guess the countervailing argument is here we kind of know everything we need to know because it's all stuff that Donald Trump tweeted and said in front of the crowd and we saw the crowd do. That said, there is still a little bit of what was going on in Trump's head during the key moments here. Who was talking to him while he was in the White House, including, by the way, just to further complicate things, some senators. Tuberville and I think Mike Lee were in contact with Trump right when this all was happening. But was he pumping his fist and saying, go get him? Or was he saying, oh my gosh, this is not what I intended at all? Now, I do think Donald Trump has already answered that question for us, by the way, because remember, he tweeted at 6 p.m. that day. That's when he sent his great Patriots Remember This Day Forever tweet. So House managers are in a difficult spot here, but it does look to me like they're tiptoeing towards no witnesses.
And Mark, again, you were up against it. Last year, it's hard to believe, because there was a Republican majority. They were not going to allow witnesses because they didn't want to open up a sitting president in the midst of the reelection campaign, as I noted. Now we have a 50-50 split. We know that five or six of these Republicans are not fans of the president and or have found, you know, refound some vertebra, which I'm glad they have. Don't you think that we're missing an opportunity here to hear from folks? And again, I think Ellie's right. I think they should be appropriate witnesses. I don't think they should be showboating. What would be the reason why you wouldn't want to have somebody who was there that day, whether or not it was someone who was at the rally as a bystander, whether or not it was a member of the Capitol Police Force? Could you even call U.S. senators or members of the House who were there as they were running for their lives?
So let me first address it in the context of last year. So when my client, the intelligence community whistleblower, came forward with the complaint, there was a great push, especially in the House, for this individual to testify. And it became, as far as we were concerned, completely a moot point when the transcript was declassified and released, or the summary of it. And other witnesses who were firsthand observers also testified. So that my client's role was, by that point, irrelevant. They started the train and, you know, they got off at the first stop, but the train was still going. But as Ellie mentioned, especially with respect to Bolton, there were some key firsthand personal witnesses to the events in question that related to the impeachment that presumably we thought at the time could make a difference. And now knowing what some of them would have testified to, maybe really could have made a difference to folks like Lamar Alexander, who, you know, stepped down, didn't run for re-election, and presumably some had hopes that he could vote to impeach, and he chose not to. Now, this case, If this were a criminal or civil trial, I fully agree. Just as Ellie described, there are a lot of witnesses that I would want to put on for effect and substantive knowledge. But because this is a political trial, and I've seen lots of articles saying, this is who we think, you know, written by analysts or reporters, this is who I think we should have testified. And while I'd say the one unknown is perhaps exactly what was in Trump's mind. So who did he speak with? What other witnesses could we get to get at that? Every one I have seen that they have identified are inside Trump people. So what is it that people would think these folks would testify to? Do you really think they're going to testify and say something that is going to incriminate Donald Trump? I mean, what we've seen in the last 4 years is that that just doesn't happen. I mean, you are either beholden to the man or you are completely on the outs. And if you are not black or white, then you're not going to say anything that incriminates him. So I would not want those folks anywhere near a trial. And I by no means would want any of these rioters, insurrectors, whatever word we want to cite to, you know, the guy with the horns who's volunteered, the shaman, right, who's volunteered to testify. Are you crazy? There's no way I'm putting someone like that on the witness stand or whatever it would be called in an impeachment proceeding, because I don't know what he's going to say. And even if I prepped him in advance, I don't trust that he's going to say what he said during prep. And they're going to make it into a show for their own ideology. Do we really think these people are truly sorry or would it do it again just because they're facing criminal prosecution and they got caught? So I would be in favor of absolutely no witnesses because, again, as Eli described earlier, because the nature of the nuances of rules of evidence, of which there really are none, we can show, the House managers can show all the video. They can show these people saying how they reacted, you know, to Trump's comments. We've seen this for the last month. There's more than enough video, audio, evidence, and statements out there that can be introduced that would go to the point of what is at issue. And I guess the one thing I would want them to emphasize is that this is really about ensuring Trump doesn't run for re-election in 2024, which I think because of his age, potentially his health, and potentially criminal actions all across the world, I'm not quite sure that's a realistic thought anyway, as much as he may push it now.
Ellie, what do you think?
So a couple of things. On the witness question, I think Mark makes a really good point about the idea of calling any of these insurrectionists as a witness will never happen. I would never do that for exactly the reasons Mark said. When you call a witness, you own them. And I've called murderers at trial, but the question is about credibility there, not mass appeal. But I would use all the many statements that are out there on video, in court filings, in public about how we did this because Trump said we do it, right? There's a great video that I think Just Security put out that shows the reactions in the crowd as Trump's speaking. And he says what he says and the crowd goes, storm the Capitol, fight for Trump. So all of that, absolutely expect to see that when we see the actual trial. So with respect to witnesses, but I agree, once you go down the road of witnesses, it sort of could lead to who knows, right? I think that, look, let's be real here. They can't drag this trial out for 6 weeks. They'll lose the public. I think they have maybe a 2-week window to get this in and get this done. And if they, you know, if it goes beyond there, they're going to start losing their audience.
Ellie, let me ask you this. Let me take a step outside the chambers of the United States Senate and talk a little bit about these folks who actually did storm the Capitol. It sounds like U.S. attorneys are putting cases on dozens of people. I'm sure there's a lot of very unhappy folks getting knocks on the door from the FBI, probably early in the morning. How many of those folks do you think will actually go to trial, serve time, be examples of what it is that happened that day, where those trials will have rules of evidence, will have witnesses? What do you think that does to both our sort of public consciousness about this, and then I guess a little less on the political side, but how does that look as someone who's, you know, again, stood at the prosecutor's table in a federal courtroom?
Yeah, I'm trying to put myself back in the shoes of DOJ. And let me say this, it's such a fascinating example because In what happened in the Capitol, we have the entire range of criminality, from about the least serious federal crime you could have, which is trespass on right, to people who just went in there and didn't do anything other than gawk, still federal trespass.
The people who walked through Statuary Hall as protesters but did not violate the rope and stanchion. They stayed exactly. within the rope and stanchion.
Right. The genteel rioters. but the crimes that were committed run the gamut from trespass on federal property up to murder. DOJ has to understand that these cases are different, okay? They need to make sure that every person they can identify gets prosecuted, because there was some reporting out there that DOJ was considering saying, well, let's only go after people who did, you know, destroyed property or higher. And there was a lot of pushback. I responded like, you know, don't you dare cut the line here. The other thing is prosecutors need to be very aware that every move they make in every one of these cases is going to be scrutinized. And I'll give you an example. Just last week, there was the story about the one woman who was granted bail to go overseas on some kind of vacation or something.
She was going to Mexico.
To Mexico. And people flipped out, rightly so, because you know what? People said, oh, how dare the judge? Ultimately, it is the judge's decision. But DOJ consented to that. DOJ agreed. And so now look, in a regular case, I don't think I would ever consent to Mexico, but I had people who, I've told this story. I said it, people thought I was joking, but I was serious. I had a mob defendant in New York City once who his bail was restricted to the state, and he asked for special permission to cross state lines 8 times to go to the Jets games in Jersey, the New York Jets games in Secaucus. Right. And we were like, I think we ultimately consented. We were like, it's more punishment for him. But the point is, you have to be aware of the perception. And I don't know how the prosecutors could have possibly rationalized agreeing to let this woman go to Mexico. You also have to push, look, the timing here. People are asking me, what's taking so long? I mean, the reality is it's reasonable. They've done 200 some cases in a month. They'll get to them all. These things take time. People said, why aren't people getting sentenced yet? It's like, why aren't people at trial yet? Trials take months. Now, look, I think you have to move them to the front of the line. I think you have to prioritize them. I don't think you can sort of engender long delays and just let people drag their feet. But here's the biggest challenge for DOJ. Two things. One, they have to get beyond the idiot with the face paint and the horns and go to the real most dangerous offenders, the people involved with the bombs that were found in the area and the people who were involved in any way in the murder of Officer Sicknick and others. I would guess they are putting full court press on both of those. They haven't got there yet, not that we know of. I'm confident they will, but you have to make those cases. Number two, DOJ, I believe, has an obligation to at least examine the culpability criminally, forget about impeachment, criminally of Donald Trump and others who spoke at that rally and others who were part of this effort. Will they ultimately charge? I don't know. I'm a little bit losing my faith in prosecutors' appetite to take on Donald Trump, but they have to examine those. They have to run real meaningful criminal investigations of Donald Trump's conduct and other people's conduct who contributed to this, because it's a weak prosecutor who only goes after the lowest hanging fruit. And I think you have to take a real look at the people who drove this and were behind this. That's not to necessarily conclude that they all committed crimes. I think I can make a pretty good case that they did, but Merrick Garland, when he becomes attorney general, owes an obligation to give this a real look, and not just let's just look at it so we can say we did, but I mean a real look, and if the facts justify a charge, bring it.
Well, Mark, let me move across the river from DOJ to the Pentagon, where, you know, there were discussions about what the National Guard could and would do. In your experience and your deep relationships, do you believe we'll see any whistleblowers that come forth in the next weeks and months that will say, I was there that day, I was sitting in a room, they said this, they said that, they should have done this, they could have done that, and they chose not to?
I do. It will depend on really what the true ground facts are. And looking at the aspect of the Pentagon and whether or not the mayor of DC requested troops to come in and whether DOD denied it, things like that. I mean, I have spoken to people who were inside the Pentagon at the time, at senior officials, and apparently there's been a lot of confusion as to really what some of the facts were. I think that's the first thing to really understand, you know, who said what, when, and what did they actually say? And before we start jumping on whether people are responsible or not, I do know because I already represent somebody who's a senior official at the U.S. Capitol Police, there are people who have information that will shed light on what information existed from an intel standpoint prior to January 6th, and then how did the agencies respond with that information? And there needs to be an aftermath. I mean, there's multiple investigations ongoing on the Hill. I've talked to several committees, and then internally in the Inspector General's offices at agencies like DHS, I'm sure the Pentagon is getting into it as well, to figure out what actually happened. And I have no doubt if we start seeing facts that are being portrayed as inaccurate or untrue, we'll see some whistleblowers who come forward. I hope that there won't be any, only in the sense that it's not necessary, that, you know, people will say what they need to say internally and publicly, and it will be truthful. So, you know, time will tell about that. And I'm out there to represent anyone who wants to come forward. We do it pro bono, especially for something like this. You know, let me make just one comment, because we didn't address something you asked earlier, and it keys into what Ellie was talking about, and that the notion of the First Amendment and that Trump's right to the First Amendment, or any of the other speakers at the rally, their First Amendment rights. Yeah, of course, they all have First Amendment rights, but the First Amendment is limited. I mean, every school child knows you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. There are limitations. Now, political speech can be a little bit more fiery and rhetoric, you know, rhetorical, et cetera. But there's always a line in our country with respect to law and democracy. And the question is, you know, did they cross the line? And I hope with respect, I think I agree. I don't think there was anything I heard that Ellie said that I disagreed with respect to prosecuting the individuals. I also hope, and I think we have seen so far, that there is a social stigma to all of these folks who participated in this rally that goes beyond prosecution. I think a lot of people are going to be disappointed in what some of the prosecutorial outcomes are of these individuals. Probably few of them will get jail time if they had, you know, no priors and they plead guilty. You know, they'll get some sort of probation and some sort of service that they have to perform. But, you know, we've heard so far that I think the Seattle Police Department has said that at least half a dozen of their officers participated in the rally that day, in the protest, in the insurrection. That scares me more than even the 20% who might be former military. If there's any current military, I hope they get court-martialed. And even former military, I think the military can examine whether they can be recalled to active duty and court-martialed. But I want to see these people stigmatized publicly. I really do. And I tend to stay away from that. But, you know, there are consequences. I use the hashtag consequences for sedition every time I see someone charged. There has to be consequences. This is not acceptable. It wasn't acceptable in the Civil War, and it's not acceptable now.
So let me close this out with someplace where we started, which was how outside the mainstream all of this has been. But whether or not it was the beginning of Donald Trump's presidential campaign in the summer of 2015, the unlikely election, his 4 years in the presidency, we could weave in any number of things he did while he was in office. But I guess my question to close it out is, can we put the genie back in the bottle? Can we go back to normal politics? Can we go back to a place where violence is not a form of political speech? Can we go back to a place where individuals are, frankly, held socially accountable for their bad acts against the country? Are those things possible anymore? Ellie?
It's such an interesting question, this idea of can we go back? And look, a lot of this, I think, is a direct result of Donald Trump. And we're seeing it across stories that we're seeing even this week, this idea of how far are we willing to go? And is there such thing as, not to get overly philosophical, but is there even such thing as real truth anymore? We're seeing it in the impeachment. We're seeing it with the Marjorie Taylor Greene stuff. We're seeing it with the lawsuits that Dominion and Smartmatic, the voting companies, are bringing against Fox News and Rudy and people like that. And I think we are moving back towards some sense of there being objective truth, there being objective reality. I think we just naturally will come back to that. But with respect to Trump politically, and I think this is sort of a perfect topic for you and your audience at Lincoln Project, when this first started, when it became clear Donald Trump was going to be impeached, I thought to myself, how's the politics going to play here? Are Democrats going to want to convict and disqualify Donald Trump? Probably, you know, they probably want to get him out of there and protect the country and probably don't want him in for 2024. But then I thought, I don't know, maybe they would want him in for 2024 so they could beat him. But the more interesting question for me is, how is this playing with Republicans? Because I thought initially somebody like Mitch McConnell, who's a savvy political operator, might well look at this and think, well, here it is, finally, our chance to cut the cord and get away from Donald Trump and have a clean break. And they're all auditioning for his base, but ultimately, where's his base going to go? They're not going to vote for Biden or Kamala Harris in 2024. And I thought there would be more of that from the Republican Party. And maybe that'll still come into play in the next couple of weeks. Maybe it's being talked about behind closed doors. But to me, that could be a determinative aspect of this trial. Do Republicans want to save Donald Trump? Keep very much open and alive the chance that he runs again in 2024. And if he did, I think he'd have a good shot at the nomination, or just cut him out and say, we're moving on without you.
Mark?
The alt-right base, the very fine people that have become at the forefront and those who participated in January 6th. Now, I've been a lawyer now for almost 30 years, and I've been dealing with Holocaust denialist cases for my entire career with those who are anti-Semitic, far-right haters. And look, they exist to some extent on the left as well, but it's a different dynamic. You know, these people have existed for the longest time, and Trump didn't create them. Trump just empowered and emboldened them. And the sad fact is, I think actually the internet is far more to blame than Donald Trump, because when I was dealing with these types of cases 30 years ago, we didn't think much. We were concerned about them, but we can contain these people because the folks that were in Idaho really couldn't talk to the people who were in North Carolina. You know, they didn't get together for conventions. It's a pain to write actual letters and mail them. But now, you know, they can foment all online, and it's so easy to meet like-minded people and engender one another and get together. And Trump was masterful, whether he intended it or not, to bring all these bad actors together. So I don't think this is going away anytime soon. And as a lawyer, I don't necessarily know how one is going to address that. I don't know if legal analysis or political analysis or psychologists, sociologists, you know, what do we need? We probably need all of us to really get together and figure out how to change this dynamics in the United States. And I guess I'd like to say I'm hopeful, because if you look back to the Civil War, I mean, that was another period of time, at least the closest to now, of where, you know, brother against brother, you know, the amount of hatred that existed and how difficult Reconstruction was from 1865 to like 1877, and the laws that we could rely on now to keep some of these people out of political office that were on the books from back then to keep the Confederacy from resurrecting itself. We got through it. But the problem, again, the difference is now we have the internet, and that may make all the difference in the world. So I don't know what the solution is, but we better figure it out. You know, whether that's creating a new Republican Party or an offshoot party, the Lincoln Project Party, you know, whatever it's going to be called. But if we don't take it away from the Trump base, which really is a minority, statistically speaking, but because of the way the system is with the Electoral College and gerrymandering has much greater voice than really it should statistically, we need to figure out all those issues so that we could survive as a people and as a country.
Well, listen, we at the Lincoln Project will be out there on the lines every day. This is a fight not only for democracy, but for decency and for a country I believe that we all want to build. And I just want to thank Ellie and Mark. Ellie, where can we find you? I know you've got a new podcast out. Tell us a little bit about that and then how folks can find you online.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, Ellie Honig. The nice thing about having a weird name like Ellie Honig is there's only one of me. Like, I don't have to be like Ellie Honig 9 or something. I'm on Twitter, Ellie Honig, CNN regularly, and Cafe. And that is where I'm doing my new podcast. It's called Third Degree with Ellie Honig. The concept is basically, the first episode came out today. We will be doing episodes every day throughout the impeachment trial, 10 minutes or less, what just happened yesterday, what to look for today, and I'll break it down and sort of get right to it.
Well, perfect. So please tune in and keep up to date with the trial. And Mark, how about you? Where can we find you?
So my name is pretty unique, and I think maybe I might be the only one on Twitter, but there's a whole bunch of Mark Zaids apparently in the Philippines, which I don't know if they're legit or not, but a shout out to my brothers out there, apparently. But certainly, you know, Twitter, markzaid.com is the law firm website. WhistleblowerAid.org is our other website. And I'm there, frankly, to represent those who have been wronged and to hold the government accountable regardless of who's in power. So I'll be, I'm sure, on lots of networks and discussions throughout the Biden administration as I represent whistleblowers and sue the Biden administration. And whoever's in power in 2024, I'll do the same thing.
Well, Ellie, Mark, thanks for joining me today. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Be sure to subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter at Project Lincoln. And for more information on our movement and to join our mailing list, visit lincolnproject.us. Also, please be sure to check out Lincoln Project Television, or LPTV. We have two great shows, The Breakdown with Tara Settmeyer and Rick Wilson, as well as We're Speaking with Lisa Senecal and Maya May. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.